We're discussing the merits of vaccine diplomacy, promoting international peace and prosperity, elevating science, sharing COVID vaccines with less fortunate nations, all the while boosting global influence. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. China, India, and Russia are demonstrating vaccine diplomacy. It appears the Biden administration is following suit, sharing vaccines abroad. The White House said last week it's finalizing plans to ship millions of doses of the COVID vaccine to Mexico and Canada. What questions do you have about how vaccines and healthcare intersect with foreign policy and diplomacy? 800-642-1234. Dr. Peter Hotez is Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and Professor of Pediatrics, Molecular Virology, and Microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine. His new book is called Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science. Dr. Hotez, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks so much for having me this morning.
Well, across the world, there is a rise in infectious diseases. Why is COVID-19 and other diseases getting a toehold, getting an opening? What are the factors in play?
Well, the premise of the book that I've just written is that we've had enormous successes over the last two decades, in part because of the establishment of the Gavi Alliance, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, which is an international partnership to expand implementation of vaccination programs across the world. So kids have been getting vaccinated like never before, with big declines in measles deaths and whooping cough deaths and tetanus deaths, and the list goes on. But over the last 5 years, I think we've started to see a slow unraveling of those things. So the point is COVID-19 is not so much an extraordinary event, but rather the culmination of declines that have been happening in hotspot areas for a few years now. And the forces that are driving it are not the things, as biomedical scientists, we often think about. They're things like war and political collapse and urbanization and climate change and this aggressive rise in anti-science activities in the anti-vaccine movement. And so I know there's now a lot of interest. There's currently a lot of interest now in climate change, but my premise is it's not climate change acting alone. It requires these other social determinants to bring it all back. And we've identified about 6 or 7 hotspot areas across the world that we can talk about where we've seen abrupt returns of vaccine-preventable infectious diseases and neglected tropical diseases. And now comes COVID-19 barreling through. And so a lot of this was both predicted and predictable.
And when we think that lack of access to life-saving vaccines, to childhood vaccines, as you say, that it's only a problem in very poor nations, or it doesn't apply to the U.S. and wealthy countries. But you found that pockets of the very poor living in the group of 20, the G20 countries, is where these gaps actually are.
Yeah, that was one of the interesting findings. You know, when we talk about global health, you know, the paradigm is poor countries versus wealthy countries, or some say the global north versus the global south, or the G7 countries versus everyone else. But in fact, when you add up in terms of the total numbers, and I did this using both World Health Organization data and data coming out of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, Seattle, both came to about the same conclusion that it's the poor living among the wealthy in the G20 countries that really accounts for most of the world's poverty-related diseases. And that includes the United States, where we have around 12 million Americans living in extreme poverty at half the U.S. poverty level, with at least one neglected tropical disease. So it's the poor living among the wealthy that are probably more affected than any other group on a total numbers basis. And that's important from a policy perspective, because it means it's not so much a resource issue. It's a matter of awareness and advocacy among our elected leaders to pay greater attention to the most impoverished populations.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Peter Hotez, who served in the Obama administration as U.S. science envoy, focusing on vaccine diplomacy initiatives between the U.S. government, countries in the Middle East and North Africa. What do you want to know about vaccine diplomacy and how it works? Should the U.S. be sharing its vaccine with poorer countries before all of the U.S. is vaccinated? Should the U.S. only share vaccines with allies? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Hotez, how do you like to define vaccine diplomacy? What does it mean to you?
Well, vaccine diplomacy has a couple of broad definitions, but it includes the fact that both at the policy level, that what we've seen, for instance, with breakdowns in providing access of vaccines to low and middle income countries in Africa and Latin America, that we, despite best efforts, we may not have given full consideration to all the nuance required in order to ensure that Africa and Latin America will have vaccine access. So it's about it's very much around health equity and ensuring that that all people have access to innovation and vaccines. That's one point. The second point is it's not only just the wealthy countries providing vaccines for poor countries. It's the idea that we need to work harder to build capacity for developing vaccines jointly between countries. So, for instance, right now, no new vaccines are made on the African continent, barely any in Latin America. And there should be greater advancement towards helping them achieve self-sufficiency for building vaccines and for countries to cooperate in developing vaccines. Like what we're seeing now coming out of Russia is very disconcerting, between the Putin government launching this program of weaponized health communication, flooding our internet with bots and trolls and destabilizing democracies. And then the Russians producing a vaccine that bypasses World Health Organization pre-qualification so far. Hopefully that'll get back into the fold, and creating one-on-one bilateral relationships between countries. It's really the opposite of vaccine diplomacy. And how do we bring that back? And it didn't used to be that way. So when Albert Sabin developed the oral polio vaccine, he did it jointly with the Soviets at the height of the Cold War. He got back channel permission to send his virus strains to the USSR. That's where it was first made into a vaccine, tested on 10 million Soviet school children. So, which ultimately helped to lead the licensure of the polio vaccine, two countries putting aside their ideologies to work together. And that's the way it should be, not what we're seeing now, which has been termed vaccinationalism, which is the opposite of vaccine diplomacy.
Yeah, you have deep admiration for the work of the late Dr. Albert Sabin, who, as you said, you know, developed a polio vaccine with Soviet scientists at the height of the Cold War. What did you learn about how Dr. Sabin worked with other nations to, you know, develop vaccine, to begin immunization campaigns? What was that secret sauce like?
Well, it provided proof of concept that, you know, science, as Pasteur famously said in the 1800s, science has no country, and how scientists, you know, under extraordinary circumstances can work together to develop life-saving interventions. And it didn't stop with Sabin. It happened again to eliminate smallpox, to eradicate smallpox. The Soviet scientists had figured out a way to lyophilize the smallpox vaccine, to freeze dry it. It was called Dryvax, and cooperated with D.A. Henderson, who came out of the CDC to go to WHO to lead the smallpox eradication campaign. Again, countries working together to solve global problems. And that's what I tried to do as U.S. science envoy in the Obama administration. I was able to convince them that we needed to resurrect this idea. And I had the opportunity to do this with Muslim-majority countries in the Middle East and North Africa at a very difficult time. So 2014, 2015, 2016 was a tough time because you were at the height of the Syrian conflict. You had the ISIS occupation.
And meanwhile, in Syria,
the
candidate, President Trump, is calling for a Muslim ban. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. We have vaccine scientist and pediatrician Peter Hotez, who views science and vaccine diplomacy as a central element of the alliance between nations and helping humankind. The new book is called Preventing the Next Pandemic. Should the U.S. guard its stockpile of COVID vaccines? Should it send doses to less fortunate nations or do some sort of loan scheme? How can the world thrive together at herd immunity? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Hotez here on the Ideas Network. you're with us for the morning show as we explore the world of vaccine diplomacy. I'm Kedar Cherkent. We're looking at the complexities of containing the pandemic within our borders and big obstacles to worldwide herd immunity. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, wealthy countries, representing just a fifth of the global adult population, have bought up more than half of all COVID vaccine doses. Should the U.S. share its COVID stockpile? With whom? Under what conditions? What do you think the world can learn from this pandemic to prevent another one? 800-642-1234. Dr. Peter Hotez is a Baylor College of Medicine professor and a physician scientist in vaccine development. He's with us for the hour. Mike is joining us from Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Good morning. I would like to know if it's moral and just for us to deprive children, their families, and other innocent people in countries like Venezuela and Iran, where we have these illegal sanctions against them, to deprive them of this vaccine and other medical supplies that they need.
Mike, thanks.
Yeah, no, it's an important question, and the short answer is no. We should, you know, everybody all over the world has the right to access to essential medicines, life-saving medicines, and even the right to innovation for vaccines, and that's a central tenet of vaccine diplomacy. So actually, when I was a U.S. science envoy, I even had this discussion about the potential of working with Iran, and because I was my major area were the Muslim majority countries in the Middle East and North Africa. It turned out that was off the table because they were already negotiating with the peace deal and the nuclear disarmament deal. So that was off the table. But in principle, I think that's something that I'd be very interested in exploring. And I've offered multiple times to various aspects of both the Trump administration and this administration to go to Venezuela and help conduct vaccine diplomacy. And I've written about this actually in the Public Library of Science. So I do think there's a definite role there, and you know, quite honestly, I don't see a downside to it. There's no downside to, there's no upside to provide depriving kids and families of life-saving vaccines.
In 2015, you were working in Saudi Arabia with the government there, and then presidential candidate Donald Trump calls for a Muslim ban, barring all Muslims from entering the U.S. What were your interactions like in vaccine development, especially interactions with a senior Saudi official who had gone to Iowa State?
Yeah, no, this is a story that I open up in the book. So the Saudis have these what are called diwaniyas, where it's mostly men who get together over tea and coffee in the evening and discuss ideas of the day, and women have their own separate diwaniyas there because it is a pretty restrictive country from that sense. And one of the things, I was scheduled to speak at one of these diwaniyas in the evening, and it was that same day that when Donald Trump was running for president, said really harsh things about Muslims, and here I was representing the United States, and people, it was clearly on everyone's mind, and I was asked about it, and I was maybe stumbling a bit, and then one of the hosts said to me, Peter, don't worry about it. Listen, I did my doctoral degree at Iowa State University. I lived with a family, and or maybe it was his master's and part of his undergraduate. And I lived with a family in Ames, Iowa for years. I know what the real America's like, and that's not what America's like. And that was an important moment for me because it reminded me that our big research universities maybe are our best ambassadors at all. We've been training leaders all across the world. And the point is not just the Harvards and MITs and Stanfords, right? It's the University of Wisconsin's, it's the Iowa State universities are amazing universities in the heartland of the country. It's training the world, and this is why, you know, America is loved and revered. It's not because of so many other things that we talk about, but I think it's because of our amazing research universities and powerhouses that are like University of Wisconsin that are reaching out to train everybody and provide, you know, the bring together some of the greatest minds in the world for that purpose. So I've been to University of Wisconsin several times. It's a place where I go to get energized, and it's just an extraordinary institution.
But Saudi Arabia did have institutions there that you could collaborate with to make vaccine development happen. And, you know, getting back to that statement you made about North Africa not having that infrastructure, how important is it to have the infrastructure in order to do this work?
Well, we're seeing a play out now, right? Because Africa is largely bereft of any COVID-19 vaccines. And same with Latin America, and same even with many countries in the Middle East. And that's because right now there's just not possible to make any new vaccines on the African continent, and just a couple of places in Latin America and really nothing in the Middle East. So completely dependent on the multinational companies. And the problem here is, you know, when we, you know, the COVAX facility, sharing facility, it was set up by Gavi and other organizations, was brilliant in its conception in terms of ensuring equity. The problem is the vaccines aren't there, because everybody focused on very high-tech vaccines, mRNA vaccines, and even some of the adenovirus vaccines that are not scalable at producing it at the level we need. For instance, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, there are 1.1 billion people living in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, two doses of a vaccine, that's 2 billion immunizations that we need to happen. So Pfizer-BioNTech proudly said they're donating 238,000 doses of vaccine to Rwanda. And it's great they're doing that, but let's face it, it's a drop in the bucket, right? Mm. We need 2 billion doses. So that's why we've been pushing to have low-cost recombinant protein vaccines that use older technology. They use older fermentation technology. So we have a recombinant protein vaccine that we're scaling up production with Biological E in India, and it looks great in non-human primates, and it's now finishing phase two clinical trials. But, you know, in the early days, you know, we had to raise all the money from that privately. We didn't really get any help from the usual sources that you would expect, because everybody was so focused on mRNA and adenovirus technologies, which are great vaccines. It's just that, you know, what we're going to do is wind up ensuring that everybody in North America and Europe gets vaccinated, but it's not going to filter to the LMICs for a long time. So there were two issues there. One, maybe too much emphasis on innovation, not enough on low-cost, durable, unfussy technologies that we can ensure access for Africa and Latin America and the poor countries in Asia. And second, not enough attention to building capacity for developing those vaccines. So I'm working with a number of groups now to see if we can build that capacity, not only in the Middle East, but in sub-Saharan Africa, possibly South Africa, and in Latin America as well.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Hotez, who co-directs the Vaccine Development Center at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. Jim in River Falls has a question. Jim, hi, go ahead.
Good morning, thank you. So I guess kind of along the lines of vaccine accessibility, I know right now with the patent protections that are on the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, that some of the countries in the World Trade Organization, you know, South Africa and some other countries like that, requested that the patent protections be taken off so those vaccines could be made more readily by other countries. And you know, the countries that have supported these vaccine developments have put a lot of public money into developing the vaccines, and feel like back, like the Salk vaccine, he didn't want to make money on that. It was for the good of humanity. And so what are your thoughts about that? And like the AIDS vaccine too, Pfizer, had a lot of protections for AIDS vaccines. Yeah. And products and
it's an important point. I actually have a somewhat view that's a little bit at variance with a lot of other people. You know, working on vaccines for years, what we have found is the cost of international patent filings is so expensive. If I have and always have modest resources to do this, if I have funds, I'd rather hire a scientist, recruit a scientist than pay for foreign patent filing. So what we've been doing is putting everything out in the public domain and in the biomedical literature, publishing every step so that we don't get blocked from doing it. And that's worked well for us. And so the problem that we have found is more so than the intellectual property is people just don't have the human capital and to know how to do this under a quality umbrella with quality control, quality assurance. They need to be educated how to do the technology transfer rather than, I mean, the patents are a barrier, but they're actually not the major barrier. It's the technical know-how. So we need to teach these countries how to make mRNA vaccines because there's a lot of trade secrets that are probably more important than the patents.
Dr. Peter Hotez is with us. His new book is called Preventing the Next Pandemic. You can join in. Are you worried about the world's low and middle income countries and how they will get access to COVID vaccines? What does this mean for new variants? Join in on Vaccine Diplomacy, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're discussing vaccine diplomacy and what it means for getting the COVID vaccine to all nations. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Longtime vaccine scientist Dr. Peter Hotez of Baylor College of Medicine says the current model for developing and providing vaccines against pandemics threatening Africa and the poorest parts of the world, it just doesn't work. Are you worried about vaccine nationalism? What do you want to know about vaccine diplomacy? What do you want to know about COVAX, the operation to supply billions of doses to poorer nations? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. Dr. Peter Hotez's book is called Preventing the Next Pandemic, and he's with us for the hour. We've been talking about patents, vaccine patents, and, you know, more of an open source approach, if you will, to the patent formulas. Will drug makers publish and share their vaccine recipes? Is that normal, sharing your intellectual property to ramp up manufacturing for the good of humanity?
It really depends. Remember how this works. The truth is, I doubt Moderna and Pfizer are really going to profit very much from this mRNA technology. The real advantage of doing this is it's provided, in some cases, government support to help accelerate the technology and to provide a glide path to get it through the regulators. And what they'll do is mostly use this technology for producing cancer vaccines vaccines for more lucrative conditions, maybe new vaccines for neuroscience, for Alzheimer's, and all that is absolutely fine, but it doesn't really help the situation in terms of making vaccines accessible for low and middle income countries. So the mRNA technology, you know, in time will get refined, in time it'll be easier to scale up production, in time it will be even maybe made stable at room temperature. And it could be a useful technology for if we were to build vaccine development capacity in Africa and Latin America and the Middle East. But we do have to have access to that. And that's going to be the tough part right there. You know, can we ensure somehow that we make these technologies both affordable and accessible to people in resource-poor countries?
Yeah, you know, Pakistan, Ghana, and others are really urging the World Health Organization to put forth a people's vaccine, if you will, you know, the global public good that, you know, could be quickly manufactured, given out for free. Is that getting any traction? Is that even feasible?
Well, it's definitely feasible, and I think we're doing it. So we've been developing global health vaccines for neglected tropical diseases like schistosomiasis and Chagas disease and other river blindness and others for many years. And over that time, we've realized that if we cannot make an expensive vaccine, we have to make a vaccine for under a couple of dollars a dose and have fine-tuned our processes for that purpose. And then about 10 years ago, we adopted a coronavirus vaccine program because at that time, nobody cared about coronaviruses. So we were able to show that we could make the spike protein through recombinant fermentation in yeast and make it in enormous scales for really low costs, and then show how we deliver the spike protein and induce virus neutralizing antibodies. And this is what really allowed the pharma companies to hit the ground running in terms of making their COVID vaccines. But we still use that old school approach, and we've made a recombinant protein COVID vaccine in yeast. It looks really good in terms of protection in non-human primates. And now we've licensed this non-exclusively to Biological E in Hyderabad, India. They're one of the big vaccine producers. They have the ability to make 1.2 billion doses. We think we can do this for $1.50 a dose. And that's moving forward. And I think this could really become the first or one of the first people's vaccines for COVID-19. The irony is, when we started this, we really didn't get a lot of help.
I'm going to just stop you here. When you say we, you're talking about the Vaccine Development Center at Texas Children's Hospital through Baylor?
That's right. Okay. So that's called the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development. It's co-headed by myself and Mary Elena Batazzi, my science partner for the last 20 years. And what was interesting was we did get a little bit of support from NIAID, you know, around $400,000 to help us get started. But then we had to raise the money privately. And because everybody was so focused on the innovation, the mRNA and adenovirus approaches, which were never going to be scaled easily for Africa and Latin America. So that was a source of great frustration that, you know, while, you know, we had to spend a lot of time. Well, we used our own internal resources to begin, but going around with hat in hand asking for funding. Unfortunately, some of the foundations in Texas came through, like the Clayburgh Foundation. Tito's Vodka came through for us. And that was, so if you're going to order a Eastern cocktail tonight with vodka, you know what vodka you're going to request. And also the JPB Foundation and a few others. And so within a few months, we had about $4 million that allowed us to quickly accelerate this and do the technology transfer to Biological E. They're scaling it up. They think they can do it for $1.50 a dose. And that's really exciting. And I hope that can make a difference.
When you talk about foundations and going out and gathering the money to be able to do the research, to do the bench science, to do the tech transfer, to make these connections in vastly underserved parts of the world, what is the role of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in your eyes in fighting the spread of infectious diseases and the way they're doing it?
Yeah, you know, we've also had support from the Gates Foundation in the past for our hookworm vaccine and helped us build our schistosomiasis vaccine program. So they're extremely important. They're major contributors to what's called CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation. And now CEPI is coming through to help, but they're not giving funding directly to us, but they're supporting Biological E in terms of scaling up production now of that vaccine. So they are extremely important. The one thing I say about the Gates Foundation, even with all of their funding, they still can't be everything to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. They're looking at new drugs, new diagnostics, new epidemiologic approaches, vaccines, and we just need that to be expanded. We need more organizations like the Gates Foundation coming in, because even they can't solve all global health problems. Even they have limited bandwidth.
What do you see as the role of COVAX in this fight against COVID-19? Help us understand what COVAX is and you know, what it's trying to do.
Well, for instance, Biological E now is committed to, that we're partnering with, is committed to providing 70% of the vaccine doses to COVAX. And what COVAX will do is kind of be a neutral broker to ensure the equity in terms of its distribution. And that's really important, because what you're seeing the Russians and the Chinese do are two bad things. One, they're not going through stringent regulatory authorities and the WHO pre-qualification mechanism. WHO is not trying to work with them to make that happen in order to ensure quality. And then second, what they're doing is they're doing these one-on-one negotiations with individual countries and bilateral arrangements, you know, largely bypassing COVAX as well. And that is very dangerous, because they're transactional like relationships, and it has kind of this Cold War smell to it that I find very unsettling. And so I think it's great that Russia and China are working to provide vaccine, but I wish they would do it in a way that integrates better with our system of global governance for vaccinations, because if they go off on their own and go rogue as they're doing, that creates a dangerous precedent in terms of what this will mean for vaccine diplomacy.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Peter Hotez, who is a vaccine scientist, a professor at Baylor College of Medicine. His new book explores vaccine diplomacy in this pandemic era and through time in history. You can join in. Do you remember the polio vaccine rollout? How do you compare it to today's vaccination efforts? Have you heard vaccine misinformation being spread? How have you responded? 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Hotez, let's switch gears here. How do you see nationalism connected to the anti-vaccine movements that are happening in the U.S. and in Europe? What is going on there?
What's going on is something very scary. And I know we're going to be heading up against a break, so we'll continue the conversation. But, this anti-vaccine movement in its modern form began in the early 2000s after publication of a paper that turned out not to be true, claiming that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine had the ability to cause pervasive developmental disorder or autism. It was ultimately retracted by The Lancet, the journal where it was published, but it gave birth to sort of this modern version of the anti-vaccine movement that took this weird pivot starting about 5-6 years ago, when it linked itself to political extremism on the far right, the Republican Tea Party, and re-energized through that, started getting PAC money, really took off in Texas. And that's when I was really started going up against it in a big way, because I'm a vaccine scientist and I have a daughter with autism and intellectual disabilities, and wrote a book called Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism, because that was their major assertion, that vaccines cause autism. I debunked that and also explain what autism is and how it begins in early fetal brain development through the action of more than 100 genes, and how we did whole exome sequencing on Rachel and my wife and I. And that kind of made me public enemy number one with the anti-vaccine groups. And then Children's Health Defense, a national group, came in, and Robert F. Kennedy started attacking me, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., started calling me the OG villain, the original gangster villain. So you're talking to the OG villain today on Wisconsin Public Radio. And this started getting very scary because it took that pivot to political extremism on the right. And now what we're seeing is it's become mainstream in the Republican Party. A new PBS NewsHour NPR poll finds that white Republicans, as they're called, are the number one vaccine hesitant group. And I partnered with a group of social scientists at Texas A&M. We found the same thing, and the Kaiser Family Foundation saw the same thing. So using different methods, it all pointed to the fact that the Republican Party has made the anti-vaccine movement front and center of its platform, and now protesting against masks and social distancing and being defiant of those things. So it's become a full-on anti-science movement. And then it globalized. It went to Western Europe last summer, and there were anti-mask, anti-vaccine rallies using that same language coming out of Texas around health freedom, medical freedom, and it took a really ominous turn. And the New York Times and BBC reported it was linked to QAnon and extremist groups on the right. And then there was the storming of the Reichstag, the German parliament, not in some ways, in ways that resembled what happened in the Capitol in January. So we are now facing what looks like an anti-science empire or confederacy. I'm not sure I knew the exact term to use here. And it's well-funded, well-organized, and extremely dangerous. And I've been writing and speaking about this, making the point that this anti-science empire is a killer, just like other forces like terrorism and nuclear proliferation, and we have to treat it as such.
Dr. Peter Hotez, he co-directs the Texas Children's Hospital Vaccine Development Center, focusing on neglected tropical diseases, other emerging infectious diseases. His lab has studied the coronavirus for a decade. Do you think vaccines deserve their own designation for a special type of diplomacy? Are vaccines a force against war and political instability? How do you feel about vaccine nationalism? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Hotez here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with longtime vaccine scientist, Dr. Peter Hotez. He co-directs the Vaccine Development Center at Texas Children's Hospital. He's dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. And during the Obama administration, he served as U.S. science envoy for the Middle East and North Africa and found vaccine development capacity requires tremendous international cooperation. And amid the COVID pandemic, a global vaccine sharing program called COVAX could lead to equitable distribution of vaccines. We've been talking about that, but there are big obstacles. The WHO, the World Health Organization, says COVAX will be the largest vaccine procurement and supply operation in history. Dr. Hotez is with us for 10 more minutes. Joe is joining us from Superior. Hi, Joe. What is on your mind?
Hello. The reason I'm calling, I'm a Rotarian and with Rotary here in Superior, and Rotary's been very involved in global health. We're an international organization, of course. Our most prominent effort has been polio eradication, which we've worked for over 35 years on, along with the World Health Organization and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So we understand the need for a global effort when we're dealing with something on the scale of polio or, of course, the COVID pandemic. And we know that while we have to, many of us are working locally to spread the word, the power of vaccines, while we can act locally, we need to be thinking globally about this effort and this crisis right now.
Joe, thank you so much. Dr. Hotez.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I should have talked about it earlier, but the Rotarians have made this extraordinary contribution to global health through their activities on polio eradication. In fact, over the years, I've spoken to Rotary clubs and what would version 2.0 look like? Let's plan for success. What happens when we finally do eradicate polio, which I think is within the realm of possibility? What would be a next great Rotary project to work on? So this is one of the inadequately told important stories around global health is what Rotary clubs all around the world have done to help with polio eradication. And I think we need more of that kind of grassroots support for global health. And all I can say is thank you to the Rotarians.
Joe, thank you so much for calling in. What have you learned about polio, where it is at, and asymptomatic spread that we might be able to, you know, inform us now as we approach COVID?
Yeah, no, it's a really important question because there's some similarities, right? I mean, the problem with, you know, with smallpox, what happened was if you had smallpox, everybody knew it. You were sick and you had that visible rash and it made it possible to vaccinate all the contacts. And that simple fact, you know, made smallpox eradication possible. With polio, by the time you see a child with acute flaccid paralysis, there might be 100 other kids that are asymptomatically shedding the virus. And this is what makes it so challenging. You have to do community-wide campaigns for polio vaccination, and that makes it tough. And in some ways, COVID-19 is like that as well. It's a nightmare in the sense that it's got this Janus face, this two-face. On the one hand, you have a group of people going into hospitals and intensive care units and losing our lives. And the other, you have lots of asymptomatic individuals shedding virus, lots of virus in their nose and mouth and spreading it around the community. And that simple fact has made COVID-19 so daunting. And that is a huge problem. And that's why we need that very high level of vaccination coverage. And now with these new variants, especially the one that's dominant in the U.S. now, the B.1.1.7 variant that came out of southern England, that is even more transmissible. So we're probably looking at having to vaccinate at least 80% of the U.S. population. That means we're going to have to vaccinate all the adults. We'll probably need to vaccinate most or all the adolescents and maybe even some kids. And that's why I worry about this whole vaccine refusal, vaccine hesitancy, anti-science campaign that came out of where I live in Texas, because it may prevent us from halting transmission. I mean, the good news, as we started this broadcast, is that the performance of the vaccine so far is pretty good. I mean, high levels of protection in terms of keeping you out of the hospital, but also now the studies coming out of Israel and Scotland showing it's actually interrupting virus transmission. So preventing that shedding of virus from the nose and the mouth. And so that being the case, it's just a matter of getting as many people as possible vaccinated, and we can vaccinate our way out of this epidemic.
Sherry is joining us from Madison. Hi, Sherry. What would you like to share?
I'd like to say that I think it's really important that we not discriminate against others in this, because the poorest people who can't afford it really affect our lives a lot, whether we know it or not. I spent a lot of time in India, and, you know, I still have seen lots of the effects of polio over there. I don't want to see the same thing happening with this COVID-19 for it just to continue and continue elsewhere in the world, and then just come back to us because people travel so much these days. Mm. And there's a lot of contention among some people that we shouldn't vaccinate the undocumented people in our country, but they're the ones who grow our food, handle our food. They're the ones who are doing a lot of jobs in hospitals and other places. If we don't vaccinate the undocumented as well as our own people, if we hold so much to nationalism, it's going to be what kills us.
Let's get Dr. Hotez to respond here.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the virus doesn't recognize your race or ethnicity or country of origin or what's on your passport. It's an equal opportunity offender. And so we need to get all of the American people vaccinated if we're going to interrupt transmission. And guess what? We need to vaccinate the world. If we don't ensure that our neighbors to the south in Mexico, Central America, Latin America are vaccinated, or our friends in Africa, this virus will continue to circulate. It will continue to mutate, and eventually we'll have variants that will resist the current vaccines. Not so far, it's looking pretty good, but this could change. And so we need to do this not only in our own enlightened self-interest, and that's often what I have to talk about, but, you know, there's a certain humanitarian aspect of this that we have to recognize, that if as the United States as a global leader needs to look after the world in this aspect and ensure that everybody gets vaccinated. In the meantime, we'll continue to do our part with our low-cost recombinant protein vaccine, and I just hope we can continue to get the help that we need to make this happen.
Dr. Hotez, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And it's, you know, not easy to get attention to global issues in this time of COVID-19 in the U.S. And so I really treasure this opportunity from WPR. Thank you.
Dr. Peter Hotez is co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development and author of the new book, Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.